Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. For those who don't know me, my name is Larry Kramer. You're not here to see me, but I'm the President and Vice Chancellor here at LSE, and it is my privilege to welcome you to this very special event co-hosted by the School of Public Policy and the Phelan United States Center. I've known Frank for a long time, but I have notes, so I'm going to do this intro from my notes, just so you know. Tonight, we're lucky to hear from someone who's unquestionably one of the most influential political scientists alive, arguably the most influential one. Over the past 40 years, Frank Fukuyama's writings on democracy, liberalism, and the foundations and future of political order have repeatedly changed the conversation on those and other crucial topics, and not just in the academy, but in the media and in the halls of government as well. Now, Frank has many very special achievements. I'm not going to go through all those. There is one, though, that's a very rare mark of intellectual fame and something I do want to note at the outset, and that's this. Despite being a prolific author who has more readers than all but a tiny handful of scholars, Frank has that rarest of accomplishments, namely that far more people have an opinion about his ideas based on headlines than have actually read the books. Isn't he the guy who said that history ended? In truth, we should all be so lucky as to write something that so many people misunderstand. So, more formally, Francis Fukuyama is the Olivier Nomellini Senior Scholar at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and also Director of Stanford's Ford Dorsey Master's Program in International Policy. Quick intro, he received his BA from Cornell in Classics, his PhD from Harvard in Political Science. In the early years of his career, he was a member of the Political Science Department of the RAND Corporation and served on the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State. From 2001 to 2010, he was the Bernard L. Schwartz Professor of International Political Economy at the Nietzsche School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Before that, the Omer L. and Nancy Hurst, you got a lot of title names here. The Omer L. and Nancy Hurst Professor of Public Policy at the School of Public Policy at George Mason. He joined the faculty at Stanford at the same time I did, which is when we met actually in the backyard of a mutual friend of ours when we had both first arrived. And from that position within Stanford's, what was then the Institute for International Studies, has been a major intellectual force across the university as well as in the world at large, because being an intellectual force across the university is actually a much harder thing to accomplish. He's the author of numerous well-known books, including, and I'm only going to mention a few of them, and to keep it short, I'm going to skip the subtitles, The End of History, The Great Disruption, Our Post-Human Future, State Building, After the Neocons, The Origins of Political Order, and Political Order and Political Decay. And you get a sense just from the titles that this is someone who thinks in big terms. All of these books and a few others have been highly influential international bestsellers, translated and published into many different languages. He was the 2015 winner of the Johann Skeit Prize, which is the world's most prestigious award in the field of political science. Now, tonight's event is going to center on Frank's forthcoming book, actually just out book, In the Realm of the Last Man, which is a political memoir. And here in the book, Frank reflects on his own life and intellectual journey alongside some of the major political developments of recent decades. So, you know, effectively from the end of the Cold War to the present day, the book considers how the political landscape has changed and how Frank's own thinking has evolved in response. So I'll just say now, copies of the book are available to purchase just outside. So when you're done, you should do that and then come back in and he'll sign the books for you. And that will be worth something someday. So Frank's going to say a few words at the outset, and then he and I are going to have a conversation for a few minutes, and after that there'll be a chance for you guys to put questions to the speaker. One quick housekeeping note, for those social media users who are following the conversation, the hashtag for today's event is at LSE Events. We always make that the hashtag, it's so clever. At LSE Events, the event is being recorded. And hopefully will be made available as a podcast, assuming there are no technical difficulties. And with that, it's my pleasure to invite Frank to say a few words, and then he and I will talk.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah, well, thanks to all of you for coming out. It's great to be at LSE, see Larry again. So I think the one thing I want to say at the outset is a little bit about the title. So the I wrote a book published in 91 called The End of History and the Last Man. The end of history was not my phrase. It came from the philosopher Hegel. It refers to history as development or modernization or a progressive story about how human societies have changed over long periods of time. The last man was a phrase of Friedrich Nietzsche, who hated the idea of the end of history. He hated the idea that the historical process should culminate in something like English liberalism, because he said that that flattened everybody's horizons, that life was really about struggle, about the will to dominate, to be greater than other people. And what I had argued in The End of History and the Last Man, using this Greek term thumos, is that what liberalism does is it distributes respect equally. So a liberal society treats every human being as having a certain base level of dignity that has to be recognized by the state by giving them rights. But I think for, well, and I would say it's been unbelievably successful in that regard. So Europe, the United States, you know, the democracies of East Asia are prosperous, they're peaceful, they give people opportunities in a really unprecedented way. But what they don't provide is really what Nietzsche was referring to, that people want something more than peace and prosperity. They want struggle, they want, in fact, I've got a line in the original End of History book which said, if people can't struggle for democracy and human rights because those victories have been won in a previous generation, then they're going to struggle against democracy and human rights, because essentially what they want to do is struggle. And I think what Nietzsche recognized was that we don't have things we want to die for in a contemporary democracy here in Britain or in the United States. And people want that. They want higher ideals that they think they can achieve through their own individual efforts. And to avoid being last man, they will struggle against, you know, the things that actually make their lives pleasant and peaceful. And I think that explains a lot of the populism and the rise of extremism on both the both the left and the right in recent years. Because honestly, if you listen to the rhetoric, especially of people on the right these days, the world was never worse. You know, that the American system in the United States is being destroyed as we speak, and they have to rise up like the original patriots in 1776 to defend it. And this is just total nonsense. I mean, in a way, the world has never been better off in terms of income, stability, peace. It's been deteriorating somewhat in the last few years, but it's been an extraordinary run since 1945. So what are they upset about? And I do think that it is really this fear of being the last man, or this discontent at being the last man, that is really driving a lot of the anti-establishment. There are other things like technology that, you know, contribute to all of this. Economic inequality, I think, is a component of this, but I think is actually in certain ways less important than unequally distributed respect, which I think is really one of the big drivers of a lot of populist movements. So just to get that out of the way, that's why I return to the last man theme in this memoir, because quite honestly, people read the end of history part, and you know, every week I get 3 or 4 comments on social media, so what an idiotic thing, you know, what's this guy was. We've never had an intellectual that was more wrong than Fukuyama. But you know, my response has always been, well, you didn't read the last 5 chapters of The End of History and the Last Man, which were the chapters on the last man and why democracy might break down in the future. So I'm trying to complete that circle with this memoir.
Although it actually raises, I was going to ask you for a first question, why'd you write a memoir? And I still want to make that the first question, okay. But then I want to relate it to the title and how that relates to you. So I get the idea, but I'm not quite sure. You named the book In the Realm of the Last Man. I assumed that was you. So how does that concept connect up to what you were trying to accomplish with a memoir, and why did you write a memoir, which is unusual for an academic?
Well, you know, my life, really, in a way, the biggest event, as far as I'm concerned, that happened in the course of my life, 73 now, so it encompasses quite a few decades, but it was really the collapse of communism, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism, because that changed the nature of global politics for the better in many fundamental ways. But what we've seen over the last decade, 15 years, is actually a reversal of a lot of those gains that we thought that we had accomplished, including in places like Hungary, Slovakia, certainly Russia never really made it to the end of history. It seems like that was a loose end that had never, I thought it had been closed, and it really hadn't. And so that was one of the reasons for returning to the question of why is democracy, despite its apparent success, so contested in so many parts of the world? Why are you seeing democratic backsliding, the rise of authoritarian governments? I guess the biggest surprise really is the United States itself, because honestly, when I wrote The End of History and The Last Man, I didn't think that we would see a phenomenon like Donald Trump, you know, somebody that could try to overturn a legitimate election and yet get reelected by American voters. And this seemed to me really central to the decline of democracy in general, because if it could happen in the United States, it could happen and is happening in other places.
Okay, but still, why the memoir form then? So that's an interesting book to write.
Yeah.
Because just so you know, when you look at it, what makes the book interesting is seeing the evolution of these developments through your own eyes and the way it's changing you.
Well, since you keep asking that question, I'll give you a different answer, see if you like this one better. There is a theme that I never wrote about systematically in the last 20 years of my intellectual development. It really starts after September 11th and then the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, where the United States used military force. They basically collapsed the existing regimes in both of those countries, and then they were left with this big task of building a state, basically from scratch, in a very anarchic situation. And it was obvious to me at that point that the Americans that were presiding over this had no concept of how you build a state. And Americans in general are anti-statist. They don't like thinking about the state. They don't study the state. They kind of assume the state always exists, and it's a bad thing because it's going to trample on our individual rights and freedoms. And so the task has always been for many Americans keeping the state at bay, trying to limit it through a rule of law, through checks and balances. But nobody ever paid much attention, at least since Woodrow Wilson, to actually creating a state where you didn't have state authority. And as I traveled and did more work in the 1990s on, you know, development, why are poor countries poor, it became pretty obvious to me that it was the absence of modern states that could actually control their territories, provide security, provide public goods, that was the single factor that was the most important in understanding why some countries are poor and some are rich. As time went on, I thought about states in that respect, but then I began to realize, well, the United States has got a problem with its state, because as Marty Lipset, you know, one of my mentors, pointed out, anti-statism has always been a core aspect of American political culture. Only Americans would talk about the deep state as this really dark, evil thing that they have to beat back, as the Trump people are doing. And that, you know, resulted in a state that actually really does not ever live up to the potential that it could or that other democracies have achieved. And this is what ended me up thinking a lot about bureaucracies and how to improve the quality of the American state, which I think political scientists have not spent enough time thinking about. So, you know, that was another kind of cycle that begins with September 11th and ends up with my concern with, you know, bureaucratic performance.
Yeah, that's funny. I wouldn't have said that Americans don't know how to build a state. They don't know how to understand that different cultures may not be suited for the American style of state. I mean, I was in the 90s when all my colleagues in con law were flying off to different countries in Europe to help them write their constitutions and basically copying over the American constitution with no sense of how poorly fit or suited it was. Yeah. Which is a slightly different, I think, although an equally bad problem.
No, that's true. I mean, I think the United States uniquely, compared to other democracies, has more checks and balances than, you know, let's say Germany, or certainly the classic British Westminster system. There's basically only one check, which is the next election. And all of the things that are in the American Constitution, you know, federalism, the courts that can overturn legislative decisions, you know, none of this exists in this country. And so there's a big difference in the way that different democracies handle that.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit, you mentioned a couple then of intellectual influences. The book goes through a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit more about who have been the big intellectual influencers, and which ones now, as you see how things have played out, have, you think, got it right, got it wrong, that is, they have stuck with you and you think are still relevant and important.
Well, probably the most important was Alan Bloom, the political theorist. I met him my first year at Cornell as a freshman. Cornell had just undergone the Cornell crisis of 1969-70, when the whole university was shut down in protests led by the Black Student Union. He left Cornell at that point because he felt that the school was not defending academic freedom adequately. But he is the one that got me. The first course I ever took as an undergraduate was his seminar on Plato's Republic. Plato's Republic asks this very basic question: what is justice? And Socrates, in the course of 10 books, goes through different understandings of justice, what's right with some, what's wrong with some. And it then convinced me to become a classics major and to actually learn Attic Greek so that I could read Plato and Aristotle in the original. And it still seems to me that the basis of a liberal education has to be this kind of philosophical consideration of really big questions. You know, what is justice? What is beauty? What is cultural and what is, you know, by nature? These are sorts of questions that I think are foundational in understanding the world. And I think that many universities have been overtaken by a kind of pre-professionalism where students are too worried about, you know, the great job they're going to have once they graduate and the technical skills they need to get that job, rather than ever being forced to really have a liberal education, meaning you're liberated in the sense that you can actually think about things. You know, you don't necessarily assume that your country's institutions are the best in the world, that there's other ways of seeing. So he was very important in that. And I, to this day, I'm really grateful that I, you know, it's sort of the humanistic education that an English gentleman of the 19th century would have gotten reading the classics, and it stuck with me because the underlying ideas are important, and I think about them all the time.
That's so interesting. I would not have thought of Alan Bloom as, I mean, because if I think about the things you've written and the themes that pick up, they don't actually resonate with where certainly he ended up later in life.
Well, it's complicated. So you may be aware that he was a student of Leo Strauss, the German Jewish philosopher that came to the United States fleeing Hitler and was quite influential in certain circles. And he was Bloom's teacher. But the second, third, fourth generations of Straussians have now all split. And so you had this West Coast group that were centered at the Claremont Institute that have all signed up with MAGA and with Donald Trump. You know, people like Michael Anton that wrote the Flight 93 article. And, you know, as, I mean, we used to call them Claremonsters because the East Coast Straussians really actually believe in liberal democracy, and these guys, you know, don't. And so that was one of the basic divisions. And I think it's interesting seeing how people that come out of a similar kind of intellectual background end up, you know, having political preferences that are so different. It makes you think that actually it's not philosophy that's driving it, it's other things.
Yeah, which actually takes to a broader question, which I'll put you a little bit on the spot, which is, so we are the London School of Economics and Political Science. Most people forget that latter part. You're a political scientist. What do you think about the state of the field of political science these days?
Not good. No, I think that the problem is that, it's kind of a general problem with the way the academy is organized into disciplines, because the disciplines are all built around methodologies. And oftentimes the people that are in different departments care more about the methodology than they do about the substance of what it is they're looking at. Political science, I think, beginning about 25 years ago, was colonized by economists. And so they imported a lot of econometric techniques, game theory at one point. Lately, I would say that probably two-thirds of the students that get a Stanford PhD in political science have done a randomized experiment of some sort. And I think that, you know, these are fine. There's a good reason why you want to do randomized experiments, but they precisely do not answer these big questions. You know, why are some countries rich? Why are some poor? Why does democracy work in some places and not in others? And I think that the discipline in pursuit of really precise causal inference has kind of lost its way, because there are a lot of subjects that are important that you need to think about where you cannot get, you know, a 95% confidence interval in terms of understanding causality. And therefore, I think that, you know, you need different kinds of approaches in political science to make it a real way of understanding politics.
All right, let me push back on that and defend some of this. So there's essentially three movements in there, right? So one is kind of what you've done is more general political philosophy. Then there's positive political theory, which actually Stanford was one of the true centers of, which is theoretical in that sense, but does say you can't actually just theorize about ideas. We need an intellectual framework in which to plug things. So we're giving you one. Now you might quibble with the theory itself, but they would say no theory is worse than a theory. And then the empiricists, on the other hand, would say, wait a minute, you can't possibly, you're just opining your ideas on what's making a democracy work. We actually can't do that without this kind of empirical work. Why wouldn't the right answer be, we actually need all three of those?
Yeah, well, no, we do. I agree with that. I just think that a lot of contemporary political science in the United States especially has gotten captured by the methodologists who think that that's the most important thing they have to think about. But you're right. I mean, the problem with a lot of my Straussian former friends and colleagues is they don't actually understand anything about the real world. They make all these generalizations, you know, having read a Platonic dialogue, you know, about the United States or Europe, and it's just completely out to lunch because they don't actually deal with the, you know, the real world. The other thing, since this is co-sponsored by the public policy school here, and this has been an issue for me for the last 20 years, is that the academic study of politics actually is not practical enough because they don't understand the problem of implementation. And again, this is partly the influence of the economists. I mean, they want to come up with policies that are optimal in a kind of old-fashioned engineering sense, and they don't think about how in real-world circumstances you can actually implement these policies. And I created this program, you know, when I came to Stanford, called the Leadership Academy for Development, where we deal with developing country, kind of mid-level government officials, trying to get technocrats to think more politically about power. You know, how do you actually acquire power? How do you use it? How do you get things actually accomplished? And it leads me into very nitty-gritty kinds of, you know, issues that are not theoretical, but they're really, you know, much more practical in nature. And again, Stanford, as you know, never had a public policy school, and I think that is a problem because that's something that needs to be studied.
You know, it's interesting, actually, a little ad here for the LSE Public Policy School, because we are in the process even of more so of actually having it focus exactly on the implementation problem. I mean, public policy schools emerged in the early 20th century to solve a different problem, which was governments were then becoming professionalized and nobody knew how to develop policy. Yeah. And I think you're right. I agree. The implementation problem is what we're running into now. We got lots of policies and just don't seem to be able to get anything done, make it work. So I think that's... Now, why has Stanford never created a public policy school? I know the answer to this, but I'm going to make him say it.
Well, I guess my feeling was that there were a lot of parts of Stanford, including the institute I'm part of, the Freeman Spogli Institute, that actually did public policy. You have the Woods Institute and other places. The law school has, you know, law clinics and so forth. And my feeling was that in order to create a public policy school, you'd have to grab all these big pieces of existing parts of the university and mash them together into a single school. And unless you had a really big donor that was willing to bankroll this, is that the right answer?
You know, no, because it's worth going, because it actually goes to something you said earlier. I mean, for me, one of the interesting things about political science departments, compared to, say, law schools or many other departments, there are methodological differences in every single discipline. But in a really healthy discipline, people embrace those differences because they understand they have to learn from each other. Political science departments seem pretty unique in the sense that people kind of stand on their methodology and reject the others and don't want to engage or end up in little civil wars. And I think there was a sense in Stanford that that all the good thinking in any event was done in the disciplines, that there were no public policy schools that had anything intellectually to offer, which of course is ridiculous idea, but is kind of deep in that institution.
Yeah,
that holds it back. And I think the reason there were some of the things that you've talked about so close to political science department was the major opponent of making those things happen, as you know. Well, anyway, sorry, we won't go into Stanford inside baseball here. Instead, what I want to do is shift to what has been, you know, even tonight and in general, the central sort of theme of your life and work, which is popular government and democracy. As you mentioned, it clearly feels like it's in decline. But talk a little bit about how bad that is. What do you see? Yes, it is in decline now, but is it permanent? Is there solutions? Where are we? What's the future for it, in your view?
Well, Freedom House, which publishes its annual Freedom in the World survey every year, has noted that the aggregate level of democracy in the world has declined for every one of the last 20 years. So since about the time of the financial crisis in 2008, when it peaked, the number has gone down. But qualitatively, a lot of big, important countries have backslid. I would say the most important of those is the United States, and that the backsliding takes a couple of different forms. So you have the rise of big authoritarian powers, Russia and China, Iran, North Korea, so forth. But you also have this phenomenon of the rise of populist movements in well-established democracies, beginning with the United States. And I think that the real erosion is more in the liberal part of liberal democracy than in the democracy part. I mean, people don't contest the fact that, you know, popular will really determines, I mean, the people are sovereign and so forth. What people really don't like are limitations on executive power. And this is exactly what's been going on in the United States, especially in the second Trump term. So he wants to do everything. He doesn't want, even when he controls Congress, he doesn't want to use legislative power to create, you know, enduring policies and institutions. He just wants to give, you know, decrees that then get followed, and a lot of them, I mean, they fall into several categories. Some of them are unconstitutional, some of them are illegal, and some of them are just very bad judgment. And between all three of these, I think it means a kind of disrespect for the rule of law, which should have been one of the foundational elements of American, political culture, not to speak of which, you're seeing levels of personal corruption that are just astonishing. I mean, I never thought, you know, as an American, you'd see a president who regarded his office as a big money-making opportunity. If you get into foreign policy, that's where it really begins to have big consequences for world order. I think that it's not possible to define Trump's foreign policy in any of the terms that IR specialists use, you know, realism or isolationism or so forth, because I think you have to go to the level of personal psychology to really explain what's... No, I mean, I'm quite serious about this. You know, his inclinations were no more wars, especially in the Middle East. He was reluctant to get involved, this past summer, but the summer before, in attacking Iran, but he was persuaded to do it because the Israelis were very successful in their initial attack. So he does that. He snatches Nicolas Maduro, and all of a sudden this light goes on in his head. He says, wow, I've got this great military instrument. You know, I can do a lot of stuff with this. I didn't think about that before. Domestically, obviously, he's using the Justice Department to go after his domestic enemies, but he's now discovered that he's got this tremendous, powerful military instrument. He's completely avoided all procedural checks on foreign policy decision making. So, you know, the American Foreign National Security Establishment has an intelligence community, the Defense Department, the State Department. All of these groups are supposed to give advice on, you know, what's going to happen if you attack, you join Israel in an attack on Iran, and they'll tell you, well, you know, they may close the Strait of Hormuz. And he completely short-circuit, you know, any of that kind of advice that he may have gotten. And so I think that it means that the world is in a very dangerous situation where the most powerful country is being run by, you know, a person that quite frankly has sort of delusions about the use of American power and has already gotten us into a war that I don't really see a good way of getting out of at the moment. Now, as to what you can do with that, I think that's an easier question to answer. If you still live in a country that can have reasonably free and fair elections, you win elections. In that respect, I think the Hungarian election last April was a really good demonstration of how that works. The Hungarian democratic opposition had been very discouraged. They'd been very fragmented over the 16 years of the Fidesz rule. But Peter Magyar was a terrific politician. He put together a very large coalition, and he didn't just eke out a narrow victory. He won a big victory where he can actually amend the Hungarian constitution and then really start to roll back some of the damage that Orban did. And so I think it's kind of a model for any country that can still have elections. I think the American election in November could also be very big. I think that opinion has changed among the people that follow this. There's been an assumption that the Democrats would take the House, but now I think a lot of the people that follow this are closely are saying there's a 50-50 chance that they could also retake the Senate. And so Trump then loses, you know, both wings of the legislature, and that also is going to have a demonstration effect, you know, for other countries.
Yeah, but that works if you have a wave election, a massive outturn against the existing government. It doesn't work if the election remains close because the public is actually divided, which let's assume that turns out to be the case in America. Because one way to think about what Trump is doing is something that FDR did, that Lincoln did, that Jackson did, which is to say you have a constitutional order. Very little of what the Trump administration has done is flatly against constitutional text. It's that it's against settled understandings.
Well, birthright citizenship.
Well, even that one, there's a textual argument against. Well, but I'm thinking of things like the putting the armies into the city, the way he's used the military. You know, those are, and so he's decided to basically seek to make a convulsive change in the system and turn it into a CEO model. Instead of three equal branches, the president is over the other two. FDR did the same thing, not for the, exactly the same purpose, but basically took a whole set of settled understandings about the Constitution and said, I don't think they work anymore, and I'm going to just abandon them and bullied it through with politics. The Reconstruction Congress, the Civil Rights Court. So in some sense, across American history, part of American democracy has always been the ability of any of the three branches to seek to make a convulsive change and then see if they can appeal to the public. So if they win elections, does that mean that's American democracy, so it's okay?
Well, yeah. I mean, if the American people really understand what's going on and they ratify that. I mean, I do think that there was a problem in the old system, and I don't think anyone, any American, should want to go back to the way things were in 2016. It was very hard. It's very hard for the American government to do things, build infrastructure, you know, launch a healthcare system that actually works, you know, reasonably well. You know, if you have Medicare for all, how's the American state going to administer a program that, I mean, the track record is very, very poor. So I don't think American government was working very well. I think one of the reasons that people like Trump and like Elon Musk is that they are very decisive and they can get things done precisely by throwing overboard all of these legal constraints on the use of executive power. But this is one of the problems with, you know, liberal democracy as a whole. The same constraints that prevent bad leaders from doing bad things are the things that prevent good leaders from doing good things. And in the case of FDR, case of Lincoln, you know, with habeas corpus, you know, they were trying to achieve progressive goals. And, you know, I like the outcome, but it is a little bit troublesome because, you know, you don't want bad leaders that overthrow these constraints, you know, for bad purposes. And I think that's what Trump is doing.
I guess the question is whether liberal democracy is the thing that's done, which is, you know, I mean, take some of your own, you know, work, right? a system of government works, it has to fit the political, social, cultural, economic conditions of its time.
Mm-hmm.
So liberal democracy emerges when feudalism collapses, which collapses because it ceases to fit the political, social, cultural, and economic conditions, and liberal democracy works. And the question is whether those circumstances have changed in our world now, that the forms of liberal democracy that we have wanted actually just don't work, and that's why they're being rejected everywhere in the world. Of course, people wanted the government to do what they want, but through what forms does not have to be democratic, and arguably that's what people are embracing everywhere, forms of ethno-nationalism. Populism is in the form of strongman leadership and all of that. And so that's sort of the question, is it possible that actually democracy was not the end of forms of government, and it's going to collapse in the same way that feudalism and imperial Roman government and so on, and what comes next?
Well, the what comes next question, I think, is really critical, because that's the one I've been asking for all the critics of the end of history, you know, from the moment I wrote the original essay. If you say that liberal democracy is not adequate for whatever reasons, you know, historical or cultural or things have changed, technology has changed, what's the alternative that you think is realistic that will actually get better outcomes as opposed to just, you know, allowing people to blow off steam and, against a system they didn't like? And I'm not sure I see that. I've always said pretty consistently over the last few decades, the only political system that I think can really be a serious challenger is China. It's an authoritarian system that is run by pretty competent people. They have a very effective state. There are certain checks on the power of the Chinese Communist Party. They're not very strong, but, you know, they do exist, and you do have a leadership that actually, you know, cares about outcomes and is pretty effective in getting there. What I don't know is whether that system is actually going to be sustainable over the next, you know, 20, 30 years. It's been pretty good up till now. The other thing is I'm not sure that that system can be replicated in other societies, because it really depends on these very deeply cultural Chinese habits, you know, that being a bureaucrat in China has been, you know, the highest calling for the last 3,000 years, right? And that just doesn't exist. If you took a Rwanda or an Ethiopia and you had a trained elite that was capable of running a modern state, you know, very effectively, I'd say, okay, more power to you. But there are very few countries that can, you know, do that. The only other ones are in East Asia, you know, Japan, Korea, so forth.
Well, or it goes to, I mean, so my answer, by the way, was to my own question, you know, is, we talked about this. Hobbes is writing as the feudal system is collapsing, and he can see that, and he can't see what comes next. All he can see is it's going to have to be some form of Leviathan, some kind of tyranny or strong government. Turns out to be liberal democracy. But it took a good 100 years and revolutions and a lot of death. Same thing after the Roman Empire falls. We have the Middle Ages for a couple of 100 years before the feudal system emerges. And the question is whether we're in one of those periods. Yeah. So the answer is, if Hobbes couldn't see it, we certainly can't. What's going to come next? But it's not going to come quickly or smoothly. And that's a kind of scary proposition, you know, for our kids as much as anybody. But it is. And you know, I that's where I wonder where there's some way. Because the other piece of it is, it could happen in Europe, but you could have flourishing governments in Asia or in the Middle East, or it could happen in one of those areas. The world is so tightly connected now that whatever happens is going to be global.
So one of the biggest changes is really in technology. I actually, all the way back to the end of history, you know, I argued that essentially the technological horizon creates the economic horizon, the economic production possibilities, and those in turn are very determinative of the kind of government that you have. And so in the age of iron, coal, and steel, you had very large combines, industrial combines, and therefore big emphasis on centralized government. I had sort of thought that the information age would unseat that, because information is power, and you're distributing information and therefore power much more equally, and therefore it would be good for democracy. But it turns out, you know, deep into the digital revolution, that there are many counter trends that work exactly against that. I think one of the biggest ones are the returns to scale in software in a lot of technology areas, where you just get these huge corporations and concentrations of both economic and now political power. that really are very hard to square with, you know, with democracy. We haven't talked about AI yet, but I think that I hear a kind of happy talk about how this is just another wave, like, you know, previous waves of automation, and people find alternative jobs and so forth. I hope that's true, but it could also be much more fundamentally disturbing to any kind of democratic political system, not just because it concentrates wealth in a very unhealthy way, but, you know, it may take away people, to the extent that it takes away people's livelihoods on a broad basis. It affects not just their material interests. You can satisfy that through universal basic income or some other transfer program, but it takes away their dignity because, you know, the reason that people feel good about themselves is they have a job where they do something that society is willing to pay them for. And to the extent that that can be now done by a smart machine, you know, they're not going to have that source of personal satisfaction.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to questions from the audience now. Now, raise your hand. Not all of you, all at once. Someone will bring a microphone. If you could just say who you are and your affiliation and ask a reasonably short question, and I'll try and spread this around some. So let's start over there with the woman with the orange stripe thing. Yeah, right in front of you. No, right in front of you. There you go. Yeah.
Hi, I'm an alum. I have a question about sustainable and replicable when it comes to the China system. So you mentioned that you don't think it's sustainable, and I wanted to know why. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you talk about the fact that that system may not be replicable as if it's a problem. Is it a problem that it isn't replicable?
So the sustainability question really has to do with the underlying Chinese economic model. I think that the Chinese leadership under Xi Jinping has made a lot of poor decisions because, you know, when he came to power in 2013, every economist understood that there was going to be falling demand and they would need to invest in other parts of their economy. And if they had invested in health and education in, you know, interior China, I think that would have been a very wise move. Instead, they doubled down on this export-driven model. Except moving now to high-tech products. And that's the part I don't think is sustainable. I mean, I think that they are in the process of undermining the industrial sectors of virtually every other, you know, advanced country in the world, and it's leading to a protectionist response. And I actually think that that's inevitable. I mean, the United States right now has 100% tariff against Chinese EVs. I don't understand why the Europeans don't do something similar, because if you destroy the, you know, the German auto industry, it's not just going to have a economic effect, it's going to have a huge social impact, you know, on the whole of the European continent. And that's the result of, I think, a very bad, you know, Chinese decision. And if you look at the Chinese economy apart from that export sector, it's not doing well. They haven't solved the property, you know, bust that they had engendered, again, by bad decision-making in earlier generations. So that is the problem. Whether it's exportable kind of depends on what you think about a competent authoritarian government. Maybe that would be a good thing. Maybe that's the only possibility in certain countries, given their history and backgrounds and so forth. I personally think that individual freedom is a good thing in itself, and if you have a country that does very well economically and is socially stable but doesn't permit any individual freedom to its citizens, that's not a great, you know, that's not a great outcome.
Okay, that's right here. Right here, I guess.
Oh, thank you. My name is Yuri, I'm the member of the public.
You have to speak up.
Hi, my name is Yuri, I'm a member of the public. Do you still make furniture? And if so, what did you learn from manual labor in comparison to your intellectual career?
Yeah, so this is another answer to Larry's question about why I wrote this memoir, because I wanted to write about my hobbies, you know, and I didn't have a good outlet for doing this. So I've got a lot of hobbies, and I like to make things. I think that it's kind of parallel to my desire to see the United States and other democracies be able to build things a little bit better than they do. But, you know, the bulk of my work has been writing and speaking, and it's very hard to know what kind of impact it's having. On the other hand, I made beds for all of my children. I made the kitchen table that we still eat dinner on. You know, all these things that are very useful. You can kick them, you can move them, you can give them to people. And it's just satisfying to be able to do things like that, that have a different kind of lasting value than the kind of ephemeral intellectual pursuits that I've made, built my career around.
Okay, so let's go up above here. In the back, see in the back there.
Hello, Cameron, KCL alumni. Concerning everything you've talked about tonight, I'd like to know, what do you think the role is of European nations going forward in terms of the decline of democracy? also, what will be the role going forward, and what do you think should be the role of Europe?
So I think that it would be bad to, as a European, to hope that the United States is going to go back to its old self at some point. We had the chance of doing that in 2020, and it didn't work. And so we got Trump too, instead of, you know, a return to the old America. So I think it's very imprudent of any European country to base policy on the expectation that the United States will be back under a future democratic administration, and that means that they've got to work together. So you have to have something like the, you know, Mark Carney plan for middle powers strengthening themselves. If you look collectively at Europe, it's got a big population, it's got a big GDP, but it punches way below its weight, what its weight theoretically should be on the world stage. And I think you can't fix that problem unless you institutionally change Europe in certain ways. And there are two parts to that. So one is just internal EU decision making. You can't have foreign policy that's made by 27 countries where any one of the 27 can veto, you know, aid to Ukraine or something of that sort. So they have to go either to a kind of two-tiered Europe or, you know, some form of more limited qualified majority voting, something of that sort, because, you know, you can't be a big power on the world stage with 27 countries that are all independent, you know, power centers. And the other thing has to do with the single market. You know, Mario Draghi is just the latest of a whole bunch of technocrats that have basically explained that Europe never fulfilled the goal of having a single market. Every European country has its own rules for labeling clothing and child toy safety and, you know, this and that. And it really restricts European countries from growing to the scale of their American or Chinese counterparts. And these reforms are pretty straightforward, but, you know, it just seems to be impossible to carry this out in Europe. So I think that there is an answer there that these middle powers could actually be much more and by the way, they think Europe's just got to spend more money on its military. It just cannot be dependent on American military power in a lot of domains the way it has been. It's just not a safe alternative, right? So if Europe can actually gird itself and make these kinds of changes, I think it could be actually a very effective counterbalance both to the United States and China. Whether that's going to happen at the moment, I'm a little pessimistic about.
Yeah. If there were a European army, I would feel the same way as you do about perhaps about rearming, but having every country in Europe rearm, given the history of Europe, as difficult as it might seem now, these are countries that spent 1,000 years fighting each other. So we've had 50 years of peace. Let's go right here in the middle. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So my name's Sophie Greatholder, and you mentioned democratic backsliding. So what do you think is the most effective way to encourage political engagement, especially among young people who might have lost faith in the system of liberal democracy? Thank you.
Well, I think that there are a couple of aspects to this. I think that, you know, the way that you prevent this kind of backsliding, as I was saying, is by winning elections and by mobilizing people. I'm actually encouraged that the number of my own students that have actually gone into politics and, you know, are kind of active in ways that they wouldn't have been 15, you know, 20 years ago. But that's a hard ask because democratic politics is boring, you know, quite frankly. Knocking on doors, organizing meetings, you know, trying to persuade your fellow citizens is a lot of hard work. But that's just the nature of democratic politics. And I think that people have to be energized about that by leaders. And that's why you need people that will actually get people out, working on campaigns and trying to build coalitions that can actually do something. The other thing related to my interest in bureaucracies, this is much more true in the United States than in Europe, but young people just don't want to go into the government. They don't see the government as a way of solving problems. They think that the government, if anything, is an obstacle. It's been captured by corporations or by interest groups, and therefore, what they want to do is go to a public interest law firm that's going to stop the government from doing something bad. And that's a cultural change that took place beginning in the 1960s. And I think we got to get back to some sense of, the efficacy of a democratic government. And you're not going to do that if young people don't actually want to work for the government. I can give you lots of examples of this. One of them that was quite interesting thinking about was NASA. President Kennedy announced the intention of going to the moon in 1961, and the United States actually landed men on the moon in 1969. So 8 years it took to do that. George W. Bush, in I think 2004 or 5, announced the United States was going to go back to the moon, and they were going to do it by 2015. Well, in 2026, we finally got this Artemis craft. They didn't actually land on the moon. They just circled the moon and then came back. Why does it take so long to do this? I really think that there's this big problem in American state capacity. And part of the problem, I think, is just, what is capacity? It's really people. People with the motivation, skills, knowledge to actually make the government work properly. And I think that people have to get interested in wanting to serve and having a public service orientation. So this is great. This is what I like about public policy schools, because kind of students that will go to a policy school as opposed to a business school, even though some of the skills may be kind of overlapping, is that, your primary goal is not making money. It's actually making the society better, through policy. And I think that to the extent that people can get energized about this, I think, you may lay some of the foundations for making things better.
Let's go all the way back there.
Hi, my name is Lucas Mordieu. And one of the clear themes of tonight seems to be that we live in a world of increasing uncertainty regarding the future of our political systems, the future of our economy, especially with how AI is going to change the world. And so kind of in this increasingly uncertain world, how can we think about adapting and sort of thinking about implementation of policy in a way that sort of fits this maybe newer world that we live in, more uncertain world?
Well, it just so happens that, I've got this program called the Leadership Academy for Development that actually tries to teach mid-level government officials in developing countries exactly that. We have a framework. You can look it up on the internet because it's free to for anybody who wants to copy it. But, we basically have three circles. So the first one is problem identification. You've got to see what it is you need to fix. Then you have solutions development. Most policy schools, particularly in the United States, focus just on those first two, right? They want to come up with data analysis and solutions to problems. The third circle is the implementation circle, and that's the political circle, because it's mostly about how do you manage stakeholders? How do you build coalitions? How do you neutralize opponents to what you want to do? If you're in an authoritarian country, you can just put them in jail, but in a, in a democratic society, you have to use other techniques. You have to buy them off, or you have to persuade them, or you have to do other sorts of things. And I think that, from my standpoint, you need the emphasis on those first two circles, identifying problems and coming up with solutions. The third circle is where you enter the realm of politics, because you cannot accomplish anything in policy without power. And there's particularly, I used to run an international development program when I was at SAIS. A lot of people in that realm don't want to think about power. It's kind of a nasty thing that other people preoccupy themselves with. But frankly, you can't do anything good in the world if you don't have sufficient power. power comes about through coalitions and the ability to build coalitions. You can't build coalitions unless you can generate trust. People are not going to follow you unless, you know, they trust what you're saying, they trust your agenda. And so that becomes a whole nother area, of knowledge about how do you get people to trust you in an age of social media and the like. How do you get resources, to do the things that you want to do? There are a lot of different approaches to this. We do a whole series on public-private partnerships because those are taken by a lot of people as the answer to it, but they're actually much more complicated and difficult. So it's a combination of all of these things. I think if you're actually going to get to real-world outcomes, you have to stop, in a way, being a technocrat and think more like a politician about, how do I get allies? How do I convince people to follow me and that sort of thing?
But, it's kind of interesting, though. I mean, one of the reasons I left Hewlett and came back to the university was a sense that within the political world in the U.S., actually all anybody was thinking about was power. So that there were those who had it. The people who had it were the wrong people. Mm-hmm. The only solution to it was to build countervailing power, and ideas no longer mattered. Mm-hmm. Right? There was no sense that the way to make change was to persuade people to think differently and you could get them to act. And of course, universities have been partly responsible for it. You have some of the ideas coming out of universities are that ideas don't matter, yeah. And that all that matters is power. And the question is, what do you do with that critique? Because I think that's certainly a big part in the younger people who were in the civil society movement, mm-hmm. which is where we were.
Well, I guess it depends on the audience. There's a lot of people, like I said, I was working in kind of international development where people really don't want to think about power very much if they can avoid it. The kind of power I'm thinking about, though, that's useful is not how do you gain the presidency and then do all sorts of, run roughshod over all your opponents. It's more like how do you build, how do you get agreement in a big American, a blue American city to build more multifamily housing, right? And that's very complicated because you want public participation, you want public input. In the United States, we don't handle that very well. We have this open-ended participation system where actually existing power holders really dominate. So if you hold a public hearing in San Francisco to build a new big housing development, who's going to show up? It's going to be the labor unions, it's going to be the developers, it's going to be the Sierra Club, a lot of existing interest groups. And I sort of think the problem in the United States is that we have a hyper-developed civil society, right? And when you invite public participation, the process gets captured by these very powerful interest groups. And so you've got to figure, and this is really what I think is kind of the frontier of democracy, is how do you get public input on a issue, not these big federal issues like immigration, but how do you actually approve a housing development project, given that you've got these local power holders, including all the NIMBY neighbors that don't want their suburban neighborhood upset? How do you actually convince them to accept this new kind of project? And I just think that it is a matter of power, but it's a matter of democratically exercised power. How do you convince people? How do you build a coalition? How do you get people to trust you? So on and so forth.
So right here, this woman right in the middle in the front row. Let's see if we can get a mic there.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi, my name is Alessia Garcia. Thank you so much. So regarding young people's disillusionment with liberal democracy, I'm curious to know what you think of American politicians that are looking to reinvigorate young people's participation through things like democratic socialism. So that would be someone like Zoran Mamdani in New York, or Abdul Al-Sayed in Michigan. I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are there. Thank you.
So I think the impulse underlying modern progressivism is a good one. because we have a society that is very unequal, and most of the centrist proposals for dealing with that have really not been sufficient, you know, to do the kind of redistribution and limiting the power of oligarchs and this sort of thing. Where I have a problem is in a lot of the specific policies that are being implemented, and I think they fall into two different categories. One is they're relatively small bore things that are really not going to solve the fundamental underlying problems. This is what I thought of Mamdani when he was first elected in New York. Like, he wants rent control. Well, I lived in rent control Santa Monica for a number of years. It's terrible. Rent control just doesn't work, you know? I mean, in Santa Monica, if you had a rent controlled apartment, you would pass it down to your children because it was such a valuable thing and nobody else would have access, you know, to that particular apartment. So, it's one of these ideas that was tried. It doesn't work. You're going to, you know, free bus fares. A lot of stuff is very small bore and I think not adequate. But the other thing is that there is a wing of the DSA that has much more radical ideas. And again, I think a lot of that is recycling of stuff that not only didn't work, like rent control, but are really just outright dangerous. This guy Hassan Piker actually thinks that it was a terrible thing when Stalin, you know, left power, you know, and I think he didn't read his history about what Stalin actually did, you know, to the Soviet Union. So, but I do think that a progressivism that is more ambitious, that actually tried to take on some of these inequality issues in a much more, you know, thoroughgoing way would be a good idea. Again, given my focus on bureaucracies and state capacity, I think that anyone that wants to implement an ambitious idea like Medicare for all has got to think about, again, the implementation thing. We don't have a bureaucracy right now that could implement something like that ambitious. And unless you build that capacity, I think it's going to fail and it's, you know, going to discredit the whole idea, and I think that would not be a good outcome.
But do you think, to follow the question, do you think the fundamental problem is a policy problem, and that what it's required to sort of motivate people to get back into and trust democratic politics is just policies that work? I mean, the truth is the Biden administration's first policies worked, and it didn't help them at all. There's something else going on, isn't there, that's producing the disillusionment and rejection of...
Well, again, this gets back to this implementation issue. You know, you take something like the IRA, this Inflation Reduction Act, that was really an environmental policy. Just like Obama, he wanted to actually speed up the build, and then also the CHIPS, the semiconductor, you know, industrial policy. People couldn't see the results of this in any kind of politically meaningful time because we have such a slow and, you know, overregulated system of government, you know, action. And therefore, you couldn't get actual results. I mean, one of Biden's big policies was broadband for rural communities. And at the end of, you know, whatever it was, 3 years after the policy was promulgated, they had not connected a single rural community, you know, to broadband. And I think, you know, that's one of the things the Chinese do really well. They decide, okay, we're going to build an airport or a bridge, and they, 2 years later, it's there. And people.
Yeah, but policies that utterly fail doesn't seem to be hurting the populists in quite the same way. So
I'm not sure about that. I think in places where the populists have been in power, they tend to get discredited because they run up against the same kinds of obstacles that, you know, the liberals do. So,
yeah, no fear. Up there, with the black shirt, yeah.
Thank you. My name is Vuk Vuksanovic, LSE alumni and a lecturer across the street at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. There were several mentions during this talk of democratic backsliding, but it appears to me that most of the time it is very binary, democracy versus autocracy line of division, Batman versus Joker analogy, so to speak. But we have seen across both Europe and Asia that a new political animal has been emerging, one of hybrid regimes, the one that combine autocratic and democratic practices and institutions. So where does this political animal sort of fit in 21st century democratic backsliding sliding and policy? Thank you.
So
I think there's not a single answer to that question. I don't think that, you know, in some cases, these hybrid regimes actually are just early authoritarian regimes, right? Sergei Guriev wrote this whole thing about the new form of authoritarianism represented by Putin. But after the start of the full-scale invasion, he's just gone full authoritarian. There's nothing hybrid about, you know, what he's doing. In other places, like Europe and like the United States, you actually have pretty strong institutions, and I think they've been relatively effective in limiting the power of would-be authoritarians, and that forces them to remain, you know, kind of hybrid. And that includes the United States today, because I think there's been no let-up in Donald Trump's wish to exercise executive power unilaterally, right, without getting past all the checks and balances. But he can't actually do that because we still have functioning courts and, you know, bureaucracies that don't necessarily implement the things that he wants to do. So in those cases, I think, you know, we're going to stick with, you know, some kind of bastardized, you know, system that's leaning authoritarian but, you know, can't go the full direction.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, thank you very much, Professor Fukuyama. Your books on political order actually kind of inspired me to do degrees in political science and now political theory, PhD at UCL. What I was wondering about was, I really appreciated how in your work you've revived Hegel with The End of History, Weber with your books on political order. And I was wondering if one of the spectres from the past is, as you've suggested, Marx, and whether is inequality, do you think, a common threat to, I guess, both democracies like America, where the top 10% own 72% of the wealth, China, the top 10% own 67% of the wealth. So is inequality in class politics a challenge to political order everywhere now, do you think?
Well, I think inequality manifests itself in very different ways in different countries. A lot of it is due to the overall level of development. So you have really stark forms of inequality in, you know, many parts of the developing world where people are still living at a subsistence level. They don't have basic services, you know, this sort of thing. The kind of inequality that you see in developed countries, I think, is different. And there, I think, actually, the bigger driver is this inequality of respect rather than a simple inequality of material resources. The two are related because, you know, having material resources also gets you social status and so forth. But I think that if you look at the origin of a lot of populist movements, beginning with the United States, it really has to do with people who feel that elites have not taken them seriously, they don't know how to listen to them, and they don't know how to talk to them. And that's also the result. I can't remember whether I said this. We just did this Chatham House event, so I don't remember whether I said this at Chatham House or I said it to you. But, for example, the nature of left-of-center parties has really changed quite dramatically over the last generation or two, where the left-wing parties really no longer have a big base in the working class, that the new division is really based on levels of education. And both the Democratic Party in the United States and the Labor Party here have evolved into parties whose core is really professional, well-educated professionals. And I think that that creates a, I mean, there's obviously economic inequality involved in that, but it's also a cultural thing that educated people really talk and think differently from people that don't have university educations. And one of the big drivers, I think, of resentment in all of our countries is the fact that people that don't have that level of education feel they're not being listened to, they're not being respected. You know, the elites are doing things, making decisions that really don't take their interests into account.
Yeah, okay, good. I was going to say, I haven't heard from this segment here, so up there. No, right there. Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Fukuyama. Thank you, Professor Kramer. I'm Ben. I'm a student in English. And my question is, do you have a nostalgia for the 1980s and 1990s, especially for those years when your book and your article, The End of History, were published? And I was wondering how much Do you think those values upheld by liberal democracy and also upheld by your book were particular to that period of 1980s and 1990s? And how much do you think the problems we have today comes from the fact that many people already forgot the period when those values worked and were upheld universally, were popular? Thank you.
So I don't have, what I have nostalgia for was the period when there was a much greater consensus around liberal democracy, where, you know, there's a broad celebration, for example, about the collapse of communism. I do think that one of the things that's changed is that people have simply forgotten what the alternatives to liberal democracy look like. And this is one reason I think we are maybe fated to go through a kind of cyclical ups and downs in our politics, because the people that, you know, so I'd be the first to admit, liberalism by itself oftentimes is not inspiring, right? In a liberal society, you have to tolerate everybody, including a lot of people you don't like. There's no common, you know, everybody's marching to the beat of the same drummer. There's no, you know, strong sense of national community. That's always been a charge against liberal societies. What really makes people desperate to live in a liberal society is living in an authoritarian country, or living in a war-torn country, or living in a corrupt, desperately poor, developing country, right? Those are the people that are really eager to enjoy the fruits of a liberal democracy. And I think a lot of the reason that you're getting the kinds of reactions from young people about liberalism itself in Europe and in the United States is that it's taken for granted. You know, we kind of assume that we're going to have a society that's rich and peaceful and basically stable, and you want something more than that. And I don't know that that's exactly nostalgia to wish for a period when everybody was really scared of authoritarianism, but I do think that's one of the reasons why our politics is different and why young people have a, you know, more jaundiced attitude towards, you know, towards liberal democracy today.
So I think actually that's a fantastic note on which to end this part of the program. So before we you know, do the end thing, I just want to remind people, for those who want to purchase a book, purchase it outside and then come back around. Frank will be up here on the stage to sign your books for you. And so I recommend that you do that. And with that, let me just say thank you to all of you and to Frank for a great evening. Okay.
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.